Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, a radio program from patients at a psychiatric hospital tears down the wall between locked wards and the world. And a century of celebrity. Film critic Ty Burr on the movie star's descent from godlike being to object of derision. We'll talk about what the fickle nature of fandom says about us. But we begin with Dronestagram. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism, or BIJ, reported this week that the U.S. and Britain have launched almost 1,200 drone strikes in Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq over the past 5 years. Previous reports confirm strikes in Yemen and Somalia and estimate almost 900 civilian deaths as a result of drone strikes in Pakistan. While the Obama administration has publicly defended the legality and ethics of using unmanned aerial vehicles in the war on Al-Qaeda, the government is largely secret about its drone program. Piloted from thousands of miles away, drones fly reconnaissance and bombing missions over places few of us have ever seen or even imagined. A new website created by the artist James Bridle posts aerial photos of sites that were hit by U.S. drone strikes, adding concrete imagery to what some call video game weaponry. James Bridle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So where do you get the information on where these drone strikes occur?
You've already mentioned, in fact, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism does an extraordinary job of collating information from news reports and from eyewitnesses on the ground after these things have happened. So I go back and I look through their records, and I double-check their sources as well in order to be able to track down as close as possible the locations where these are occurring.
And then you find these locations from Google Earth and post them. Now, I want to be clear, we're not getting a post-explosion photo because Google Earth photos have been taken over previous years. So what are we seeing, James?
Well, what you're seeing is the landscapes of these battlefields, essentially. It's very strange to me that we hear a lot about these places on the news, or in fact, sometimes we don't hear very much about them at all, but we very rarely see them. They take place in locations that pretty much none of us have visited, and very few of us are likely to. And in fact, no journalists visit there, and in fact, no kind of troops visit there at all. These are landscapes that are kind of only accessible to the military via these kind of robotic planes. But there are people there, and there are houses there, and there are roads, and there are schools, and there's all this kind of stuff. But it's a battlefield that we don't see, and we don't think very much about that because we're so used to kind of 24/7 television and newspaper coverage.
Yeah, we can discern cars, buildings, you know, outbuildings, pictures, of course, taken high above the earth, with the odd effect of making them appear a little flat and abstract. And I was thinking, looking at them, you could be a passenger in a drone if there were such a thing. Is that what you're aiming for, the look of what one would see if one were in one?
Yeah, I mean, the aesthetic of these things is very much the kind of the drone's eye view of this landscape. I think that's a shame in one sense, because I am trying to bring these things closer. I am trying to make them distinctly more visible. And of course, there is always a distancing effect by a kind of aerial shot of this nature. You know, in some cases, you know, locals have taken, you know, more up-to-date pictures of these places, and you can go onto the internet and see them. But this is kind of as close as it's possible to get, really, from a distance. But I think that's quite important and key as well. We're not being shown these places, but we do have the technology to access them to some extent.
Mm. Dronestagram has been up for a few months, but this is not your first project looking at drone warfare. I was looking at a previous project called Drone Shadows, where you traced out the shadows, like a silhouette of a drone on the ground, you know, in parking lots and on streets. I'm wondering, James, what is it about drones that your work is exploring?
My work has always explored the kind of strange intersections of technology and culture. So I used to be a publisher, and from then I was exploring why literature has changed by coming into contact with ebooks and the internet. And from there, it's become a wider exploration of how all of culture is changed by its encounter with technology and the network. For me, drones stand quite specifically for the kind of the very distant reach of the network. They're this kind of disembodied technology, or they're very much embodied, but distanced from us. They allow us to reach out and see and act at this kind of incredible distance, just as the network does. But unlike a lot of the kind of social tools that we use every day, it doesn't feel like it's bringing us closer together. In fact, in this case, it's being used to kind of obfuscate and conceal. So Dronestagram is intended to kind of bridge that gap, basically, to bring together those two technologies, the same technology which is being used both to conceal and to bring together and to show them both. And the Drone Shadows project is quite similar in many ways, because it struck me that I'd certainly never seen a drone in real life. I'd never stood in front of one. And when I started thinking about it, I had no real way of visualizing it. I had no idea how big it really was. So the project started very simply as sketching one of these things out in order to understand its size and therefore to be able to think about it more clearly.
I'm looking at Dronestagram now. Here's one entry from October 23rd, 2012 at 5:27 p.m. in Yemen. An evening strike on a car killed at least four alleged Al-Qaeda members in the Marib province, several miles outside Marib city, sources reported. And then, you know, they talk about the bodies blown to pieces, not identified. You have several different sources here, references of the Associated Press, AFP, Reuters, Yemen Post, Long War Journal, Xinhua. Now, you're an artist, but also serving, I think, as a reporter in a sense. Looking at these several sources that you reference, you must check these things out. Are you prepared to be in that position, James, to be looked at as, you know, sort of an authority on drones?
I wouldn't call myself an authority on drones in any way, but I mean, I've certainly been interested in this area for some time, so I've learned a huge amount. And this work sits atop a huge amount of other work done by professional journalists who are far more skilled at the investigatory portion of this than I am. But what I am, I guess, interested in is how we tell these stories in the language of the network. At a time when, you know, we're bombarded with kind of news stories that are very easy to kind of gloss over and ignore, we spend all our time in kind of other places, in places like Instagram and on Twitter and on Tumblr, these social networks, which portray, you know, a personal reality, our social reality, the reality of our friends. So trying to speak about current events, about what I consider to be important events in those spaces and in the language of the network itself, I think is a kind of a writerly and artistic task that's very closely tied to journalism.
James Bridle, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The artist James Bridle, he blogs at The New Aesthetic and book2.org. And we do have a link to his Dronestagram Tumblr to see Google Earth images of sites targeted by drone strikes, as well as the IBJ project reporting on drone strikes. There's plenty of information there. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org and also on Facebook and Twitter. The funeral industry is embracing the digital age with beefed up websites to include social media, tributes, and photographs of the departed. One New Hampshire mortuary is picking up on a national trend, providing live webcasting of memorial services. That got our attention. Word of mouth intern Ali Kuzmikas went to find out more.
Stephen Purdy isn't your typical funeral director. When a family asked him to create a live webcast of a memorial service, it was the first in New Hampshire. And even though Purdy had no web streaming experience, he didn't say no.
I was like, sure, we can put that together for you. Never done it before, but we'll get through the kinks and we'll get it done. And sure enough, it just went off without a hitch. It was really easy to do.
With a video camera, laptop, and online support, Purdy made a web page where anyone with the link could watch the service in real time. The technology may come across as impersonal, but Randy McCullough, deputy director of the New York State Funeral Directors Association, says it's really just another tool to help grieving families.
There's probably, I would argue, no better way than this way to enable someone to remember a decedent, someone that they really cared about, remembered, affiliated with, whatever that relationship was. I think there needs to be a process for closure, and I think this type of technology enables it without question.
John Erickson, who's executive director of the Pennsylvania Funeral Directors Association, says it's a positive thing that it connects people at a distance, but it can never replace actually being there.
If you're a relative and you love the person who died, more than likely you're going to come home or attend the funeral in person. The whole purpose of attending a funeral is to help the grieving, and more than likely they're going to be there and you're going to want to talk to them and be with them.
After the funeral is over, the webpage stays live for 2 weeks. Online donations keep the page going longer, and $300 makes it permanent. The recording could be hosted on the page and would probably sound a lot like this webcast service from Conley Funeral Home in Illinois.
Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and I am the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, yet shall they live. And whoever lives and believes..."
Purdy says that most people won't plan to have an online funeral, but he'll continue to offer the service.
For them to have that option on a moment's notice to have the live webcasting done, I think will be of great help to families in the future.
A month after his first live funeral webcast, Purdy spoke with the woman whose husband had died. She had just watched the recording of the funeral.
She was like, "I got so much more out of the service because, you know, I wasn't so emotional, you know, at that point with everything going on and all my guests there. I was really able to sit down and listen to what the clergy said and really take everything in."
It was a benefit Purdy didn't expect. But does it mean that online funerals will change the way people mourn? John Erickson doesn't think so.
You know, all these forms of communication, whether it be phone or Skype or web streaming or whatever it might be, all have benefit, but it's never going to replace, in my view, I may be an old curmudgeon about this stuff, never going to replace being physically there.
As for Purdy, he's already onto his next innovation. In January, he's launching a new division of pet services that offers same-day memorial service and cremation, the first of its kind in New Hampshire. For Word of Mouth, I'm Allie Kosmikas.
For more on web-streamed funerals and to see a video of that webcast memorial Allie mentioned, go to our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, want to meet some tough women? Get thee to a nunnery. We'll hear about just a few unconventional ladies who've worn the habit. After the break, with more Word of Mouth. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're listening to Radio La Colifata, the world's first and largest radio station broadcast from a psychiatric facility. Since its inception 20 years ago, similar stations have launched in what are often still called insane asylums across South America and Europe. Here in the U.S., the idea of putting mentally ill people in locked wards on the radio sounds like a lawsuit waiting to happen. Psychologist Amelia Rachel Hokulea-Borovsky made several visits to El Borda National Psychiatric Hospital in Buenos Aires to see and hear Radio La Colifata for herself. She wrote about the experience for The Atlantic, and we reached her in Hawaii via Skype. Amelia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
So what does Colifata mean?
Colifata actually means crazy lady, and the patients, although they're not called patients there in Buenos Aires, they're called the interned, or the people that live on the inside. They named Colifata themselves, and it's in the dialect called Lunfardo, which is a prison dialect that was used in Buenos Aires so that prisoners could talk to each other and that prison guards wouldn't understand. So it's kind of a language of resistance and a language of empowerment. Psychiatric patients at the hospital reclaimed the language and the name crazy and took it on for themselves. We are crazy radio.
They're sort of making fun of this idea of the crazy ones on some level. Have I got that right? I mean, is that something you see when you were at the hospital?
Absolutely. It's very, very playful. This psychiatric hospital also has circus workshops. They have tango workshops. They have a huge art center. I even saw a art student working with a patient with a blowtorch to do metal welding. I really did think I had landed in Alice in Wonderland's down the rabbit hole because you would never, ever see that in a U.S. psychiatric hospital.
How about the hospital itself, how it looks physically? I did watch some scenes from a film, a documentary film that was made about Radio La Colifata a couple of years ago. And we see these kind of peeling walls, these industrial green tiled rooms. I think for many of us, the notion of what it looked like inside of a psychiatric hospital here in the U.S. is kind of frozen in a film like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. What is the difference here?
Well, exactly, Virginia. From the outside, La Borda National Psychiatric Hospital in Buenos Aires looks like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It recalls the days of psychiatric hospitals from the 1950s and the 1960s in the United States, a lot of which have been closed down. It's big, it's creepy, there's paint peeling, there's graffiti all over the walls that actually says, you know, don't close us down. Anyone can just walk into the psychiatric hospital in Buenos Aires. You don't need identification, you don't need to sign anything, you just walk right in. And when you get in, it's just a huge courtyard with trees. There's a big yellow building for the radio station. There's a beautiful mosaic. And all these white plastic chairs set up in a large circle. There's about 50 people that come every Saturday for the radio station. And it just feels alive. There's patients walking around. There's community members. There's university students. And you can't always tell who is who.
Amelia Rachel Hokulea-Borowski is with us. She is a psychologist and a writer, and she visited Radio Colifata, which literally means radio for, I guess, the crazy people, which broadcast from a national psychiatric hospital in Buenos Aires. What was the programming like? What were they doing? Playing music, plays, what?
So the programming at Radio Colifata was just very alive and honestly very crazy. One of the main things about being in a psychiatric hospital, and I don't want to compare it exactly to being with children, but there is a sense of being unfiltered. People take a microphone and share whatever is on their mind.
Radio La Colifata.
La filosofía era un tema de los eruditos.
Sabias palabras.
Bueno, debo decir.
The way it starts is Dr. Alfredo Olivara, who started the program, he writes on a blackboard the plan for the day. But of course, the plan never gets followed. It usually starts about 2 in the afternoon. Everyone gathers and sits in these white plastic chairs. And everyone introduces themselves. There's hugs and kisses that go around. There was this man, Hugo, who wore these little glasses and looked kind of like a turtle and like a 1920s intellectual. And I was immediately intrigued by him. And he's a Don Quixote of the radio station. He shares all this news and political insights. He actually managed to get me to stand up with him. Not that you can see this on the radio, but it was a really beautiful moment. And dance hula with him and teach him how to dance hula in the middle of the courtyard in the psychiatric hospital.
What an image.
And then he managed to, you know, turn it into part of the radio show and talk about global warming. And then he threw everyone a huge luau and asked me, you know, what are we going to serve at this luau? And just a real feeling of community.
Do they boil it down and edit it to something that's broadcast nationally?
They do. So it's live and broadcast nationally and internationally. You can sign up from Skype. When I was there, we had people Skyping in from Uruguay and from Mexico to listen live. And then what they do is they edit it into little segments, sometimes just 5 minutes. And these are broadcast throughout the week nationally. So everybody in Argentina knows about Radio Colifata.
In fact, your taxi driver who drops you off says, everybody listens. So what's the appeal for the average listener, for the person who is on the outside?
You know, people are naturally drawn to finding out what goes on in psychiatric hospitals. I think we want to know what is the wall that separates us and how thin is it. There's something powerful about hearing that voice of someone who, you know, may or may not be psychotic in that moment or who just has an insight from their perspective to share.
you do some comparisons about how it could happen in the U.S. or whether it could even happen in the U.S. And I would imagine there would be a lot of accusations of voyeurism of some type or accusations of taking advantage of people who may not, you know, be within their full power to make decisions for themselves.
Yeah, Virginia, when I first was working in a forensic psychiatric hospital, I thought it would make an amazing radio station show because of all the stories that go on in there. And also, as an activist, and I want to make this point, the radio station also serves an important tool of transparency. One of the Saturdays that I was at the radio station, a patient came up and started whispering to Dr. Oliveira, the director of the radio station, and he immediately stopped the show and gave this interned psychiatric patient the microphone. And the patient started detailing some of the things that were going on in the psychiatric hospital. The heat had been cut off. The plumbing had been broken. And this was a way for the patient to communicate to the whole country that things were not functioning as they should within the psychiatric hospital. So the administration doesn't always love Radio Kolifata, but it's such a popular radio station that they can't do anything about it. And so it does also allow for this kind of transparency and accountability. So that's one reason I don't think it would happen. But the other reason is confidentiality. You know, in Buenos Aires, they use their real names and no one is concerned about this. And as I said, anyone can just walk in. It's not a litigious place. And in terms of voyeurism, I think that's much more our concern than it is of the patients. A lot of people who struggle with mental illness naturally have different voices going on in their minds and sometimes externally as well. So radio is a really natural medium and a very therapeutic medium in which to externalize these voices. So for them, it's empowering.
Maybe you couldn't necessarily launch a radio station like this in the U.S., but how can you use it in your individual practice, in your individual outreach with people who need your help?
To be honest, Virginia, I am no longer working as a clinical psychologist because I've been really burnt out by the system, to be honest. I have found administrations in most hospitals and in most clinical settings pretty apathetic and not really willing to take these kinds of risks. So I can't say that I've necessarily found a way to bring that experience from Buenos Aires here to the United States yet, other than through just sharing the experience.
Well, as big radio advocates, we're so glad that you shared the experience with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
Buenas tardes. Aquí transmite LT22 Radio La Colifata directamente del Hospital Borda.
Psychologist Amelia Rachel Hokulea Borofsky visited Radio Colifata at El Borda National Psychiatric Hospital in Buenos Aires. She wrote about the experience for The Atlantic magazine. You can read it for yourself and share it on the Word of Mouth Facebook page. Maria singing from the Alps, Audrey Hepburn in a habit, the flying nun at cruising altitude. The stereotypical nun is neither action hero, rock star, nor clan fighter. That's why we found a recent list of gutsy nuns and mental floss so intriguing. Freelance writer and frequent word of mouth guest Clay Wirestone wrote the article and is with us to run down some of history's boldest sisters. Clay, great to have you back.
It's great to be here.
So many women did get themselves to nunneries throughout history, and their stories have pretty much disappeared, but were you surprised to find out about all these feisty nuns?
A little bit. There were many more than I could even use in the article, but I came to realize that for so long, if women didn't want to get married or if they wanted to continue studies in one way or another, their only option really was a life of religious service.
So some of them that you found, let's go to the bold warrior nun, who some called the Tibetan Joan of Arc, Ani Pachin, if I'm saying that right.
I think so, yes. She was a Tibetan Buddhist nun. She was born in 1933 to the leader of a powerful clan. Unfortunately, he died just a couple of decades later, after she'd already started some religious studies. The Chinese at that point were invading Tibet. They were kind of taking it over, and she actually took up the leadership of her clan, leading up to 600 warriors on horseback against, you know, Chinese tanks. She was unfortunately captured soon thereafter and then spent some 20 years in prison. After she was released, she then had a really kind of epic escape across the mountains on foot to finally join the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan government in exile.
What a story. Another warrior of sorts, Catherine Drexel, who you called the crusading heiress. Now, what is her story?
Well, she came from a hugely wealthy family. Her uncles founded Drexel University in Philadelphia, and she was really focused on education. She thought the real solution to poverty for African Americans and Native Americans was education, was schooling. And she was originally just going to donate money, as many people in her family had. But when she and her sister were touring Europe in 1887, they met Pope Leo XIII, and he suggested that Catherine actually enter the religious service herself. So she ended up starting her own order. She called it the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament for Indians and Colored People, and ended up founding more than 60 schools in the South and Western U.S., and played a huge role in the founding of Xavier University in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Now, she used her fortune to support her work. Now, does that signal a kind of independence from church doctrine? I'm just curious about how the church regarded her and other bold nuns.
Well, Catherine Drexel was eventually canonized. She is Saint Catherine now. She was obviously very well regarded. I think a lot of it depends on how effectively these women worked inside the hierarchy of the church, which was, after all, still a male-dominated organization.
Let's move on to the story of Juana Inez de la Cruz. You dub her the genius in the convent. Who was she?
She was a Mexican prodigy who lived in the latter half of the 1600s, but she was born illegitimate, which was really the root cause of all of her problems, because she wanted to study, she wanted to write, and even though she had friends in the nobility, they weren't really willing to underwrite her after the age of 18 or so. She didn't want to get married, so she entered a convent. And, you know, at that point, she kind of flourished. She wrote a lot of poetry. She amassed a library of over 4,000 volumes. But, you know, that eventually gained the attention of the church authorities, who weren't so fond of independent thinking and also some of the more sensuous aspects to the poetry she wrote. And so she was eventually forced to renounce the library, renounce her writing, and then she died from the plague a couple of years later. So not all of these stories end very happily.
I guess not. We're talking about Mother Superior. That's the title of an article in Mental Floss magazine written by our guest, Clay Wirestone. Let's talk about one who had a pretty glitzy life before entering the convent. Now, this is the Hollywood starlet, Mother Prioress Dolores Hart.
Well, Mother Prioress came a little bit later. But yes, Dolores Hart was a rising starlet in the late 50s and 60s. She starred in, I believe, Loving You with Elvis Presley, and also was on screen with Montgomery Clift, but she'd always felt the pull of religious life, so she made her break from Hollywood at age 24 to go out to Connecticut to join an abbey. But the thing was is that she didn't end up turning her back on it entirely. She had Hollywood connections with Patricia Neal and Paul Newman. She leaned on them to help build a performing arts center at the abbey, and in the 1990s, she asked to rejoin the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So now she and her fellow nuns watch the Oscar screeners every year and help pick their votes.
I've saved my favorite nun for last, the religious rock star Hildegard von Bingen. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, you have to go back a long time for Hildegard. She was born in 1098, and she had visions from a very early age, vivid hallucinatory visions. But she didn't tell anybody about them until age 43, at which point then she started writing poetry, she started writing books describing these mystical revelations, and she started writing music as well. She gained a lot of followers and founded her own convent at the age of 50, and then she actually started touring the countryside, giving talks.
Drawing crowds?
Yes, which of course is amazing because she was in the Catholic Church when women were not supposed to preach, and she explained it by saying she was hearing these words directly from God, and so she wasn't actually interpreting it, she was just relaying the message. But, I mean, I think if you look at that today, I mean, like, where she's from, you know, today she would have been someone like Angela Merkel or perhaps Hillary Clinton. I mean, she had that much charisma and that much power.
Any of the contenders that didn't make it into the article that stick with you?
I believe her name is Catherine the Astonishing. She apparently was resurrected at her own funeral and flew up into the rafters. You know, not sure how true that actually was.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Clay Wirestone.
Always a pleasure.
Clay Wirestone is arts editor for the Concord Monitor and a regular contributor to Mental Floss magazine, where you can find the article about history's Mother Superior. Coming up, a modern biography of fame, Globe film critic Ty Burr on how the mighty have fallen, when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stars, they're just like us. The popular feature in Us magazine shows us pictures of celebrities in sweats, going to the supermarket, the park with their kids, how familiar they seem, and how far our notion of fame has come since the days of movie idols like Douglas Fairbanks and Greta Garbo, who might as well have lived on Mount Olympus.
I am my own boss. The fuck that in your pipe and smoke it.
Gods Like Us is a new book by the Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, which follows our evolving obsession with fame. Burr traces the on-screen and private lives of celebrities from Charlie Chaplin to Julia Roberts to create a cultural biography of modern stardom and fandom, that fine line between audience adoration and resentment. Ty, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Before there were screens everywhere, there was one that mattered, the silver screen at the cinema. One of its earliest stars was Florence Lawrence. Who was she?
Right. She was the first star that had a name. One of the things I try to explore in the book is how the history of movie stars is a history of secrets gradually being revealed. And the first secret for early movie audiences was the actor's names. There were no names when you went to see a movie. You'd get the title of the film and the company that made it, and that was it. And after about 10 years, the audiences started to go nuts because they had this really intimate, new kind of relationship with these people on the screen who seemed so close, but they didn't know who they were. So they started writing letters to the studios and to the actors begging to know their names. And there are letters that say, please tell me your name. I won't tell anybody. It'll be our secret. And finally, one of the independent studio heads, a guy named Carl Laemmle, who went on to found Universal Pictures, figured it out, and he poached an actress from another company and publicized her by name, Florence Lawrence. And then he did something really unusual. He killed her off. He put out a news report that she'd been run over by a streetcar, and then put out a correction saying, no, she's alive, and by the way, you can come and meet her in person in St. Louis on Sunday. And it was the first movie star mob scene. Thousands of people descended upon this poor actress who had no idea what was going on. And that's really where the starting gun for modern stardom as we know it.
Well, and the other part here is the studio faking her death. Early film studios carefully orchestrating the images of their stars. So Hollywood got it pretty quickly. Could Hollywood just choose to anoint celebrity on anybody?
Well, they could certainly try. And, you know, Carl Laemmle was ahead of the curve. But by the late 20s, by the silent era, and certainly once you get into the 30s and the great movie factories, they were in the unusual position of manufacturing unique personalities on a mass scale. It's very paradoxical. And yes, they would take these young actors and they would mold them and they would make them into what they thought people wanted to see. Clark Gable, for instance, he was a footloose young actor who landed in Hollywood, made 12 movies in 1931 and made everybody sit up and go, who is this hunk? At which point MGM decided they were going to try and tailor his personality, and they would send him out for photo shoots where he's hunting and fishing and doing all these man's man things. And he didn't do those in life, but he picked them up. He started hunting, he started fishing, he started playing polo. He's basically reversed engineered his personality from his persona.
Well, some of the prevailing early gods, the Charlie Chaplins, the Mary Pickfords, the Douglas Fairbanks. You write that it was the stars that gave movies appeal. Fans wanted them to remain kind of unchanged, really, from picture to picture, as you were saying. Now, all this really changed for the early stars with the advent of sound. Here is America's sweetheart, Mary Pickford, in her first talkie, Coquette, from 1929.
My gracious, darling. After that, you'd have to forgive me for murder.
Yes, that's the trouble. What do you want me to forgive?
No, say you'll forgive first.
I'll forgive.
Oh, I don't reckon we're so terribly much anyhow. I sort of got things twisted. But I was wondering, did we have a date to go to the dance tonight?
Mary Pickford from the 1929 talkie, Coquette, a nice southern accent there. Ty Burr, you write about this change in technology as a baby step toward giving the audience control of the machine. What do you mean?
What I mean is that the history of movies and the history of fame over the course of 100-plus years of popular culture is really the history of technology gradually bringing the tools of celebrity closer to us, bit by bit. You go from silent films to the talkies, where we can hear what people actually sound like. When TV comes in, we've got a box in our room. you know, in our living room that brings the stars to us and changes them. All of a sudden, they're not glamorous movie stars, but they're people like you and me, Jackie Gleason, you know, as Ralph Cramden, Lucille Ball as Lucy Ricardo. And then as you move further on into modern times, cable TV and the VHS, the videotape revolution. And then, of course, we eventually get to the Internet, where the means of stardom are at last in the hands of the people, where, you know, my teenage daughter can come home after school, shoot a video, edit it on her laptop, put it out on YouTube, and have it seen, in theory, by everybody on the planet, which 100 years ago, only Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin.
Mm-hmm. So the gods cease to be gods when everybody can play them, I guess.
That's right. What happens to the old school movie stars when that happens? Well, they get mocked in many cases.
Well, this cutting them down to size reveals this dual nature of our love for them that you write about continually, how that shifts in the book. So what's behind that, this kind of, you know, fine line between adoration and envy?
Envy is a very good word. A scene I kind of revisit through the book is the mob scene. It happens to Florence Lawrence. It happens to Shirley Temple. It happens to Clark Gable, where they go out in public and they're besieged by this crowd that literally tears at their clothes and rips their buttons off and grabs at their shoes, and it's almost as if they're trying to devour them. We have a very complicated love-hate relationship with celebrities because we adore them, because we think somehow because they're on TV or in the movies they're better than us, but we also resent them because how dare they elevate themselves to that position? Why aren't they grateful when they misbehave? And also, we want some of that for ourselves.
That's the Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. He's with us to talk about his new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. Well, let's get to some of these kind of seismic shifts in the way that we think about celebrity. Three that you talk about that transformed pop culture in the decade after World War II, the first being Marlon Brando's recalibration of the male performance and Hollywood stardom, then rock and roll, then the unstoppable rise of TV. But I'd like to focus on Brando. Here he is playing Stanley Kowalski in Elia Kazan's 1951 film of the Tennessee Williams play, A Streetcar Named Desire.
Go wash up and then help me clear the table.
Now, that's how I'm going to clear the table. Don't you ever talk that way to me. Pig, Polack, disgusting, vulgar, greasy. Those kind of words have been on your tongue, and your sister's tongue is too much around here. What do you think you are, a pair of queens? I just remember what Huey Long said, that every man's a king, and I'm the king around here. And don't you forget it.
Whoa, we can hear this smoldering hostility. I cannot imagine out of any actors preceding him. What makes him stand out as a celebrity?
Things. He changed film performance, how you were supposed to be on stage and in film, and he also changed people's approaches and attitudes towards stardom. He seemed to be real. And the thing I talk about in the book is we're always, each generation sort of kills off its parents' movie stars in a search for something that's more relevant, more real to them. And Brando in 1949 was about as real as it got. There are stories of him coming on stage in his Broadway days and people thinking a stagehand had wandered on stage. There was nobody doing anything like him, and it was threatening. As a star, he was the first star to say, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Stardom is for kids. It's for babies. It's childish. I want nothing to do with it. And to sort of erect this sense of hostility around the whole notion of stardom, which, of course, made him a bigger star than ever, much to his confusion.
In fact, he told the New York Post, the theater's just a job like slicing bologna, you know, but the pay's better.
And there's a whole male lineage that descends from him, you know, from James Dean to Robert De Niro to Edward Norton to Ryan Gosling, of actors who wear their stardom like a hair shirt and for whom acting is this great macho mystery. And I think with the arrival of Meryl Streep in the 80s, you sort of see the female Brando, not that, you know, and there's no hostility there, and there's none of the sort of agonizing over stardom, but there is a deep, deep immersion in craft and a willing to almost like disappear into a role.
And Meryl Streep also signaling for you the return to glamour in Hollywood, the Harrison Fords, the Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is one of the actors that kind of signaled that departure from the everyman, you know, the Dustin Hoffman or the Steve McQueen, who didn't necessarily have the movie star looks. Here he is, showing a kind of uber masculinity in the 1986 film Top Gun.
The best driver in his reel from each class has his name on it. You think your name's going to be on that plaque?
Yes, sir.
That's pretty arrogant, considering the company you're in.
Yes, sir.
I like that in the pilot.
Well, he doesn't say much, but Cruise certainly held his own at the box office in the 80s and 90s. When did he transition from star to object of ridicule?
We've always had a funny dance with Tom Cruise. I think he's actually one of the most fascinating figures in American stardom. In the 80s, he allied himself with Paul Newman in Color of Money, Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. Then he gave an Oscar-nominated performance in Born on the 4th of July. For a while there, he wanted desperately to be taken seriously as an actor, and nobody took him seriously as an actor. And you know what? His performances in those films are actually very, very good. And I find it hilarious that the year he was actually nominated for Best Actor for Born on the 4th of July, it was the same year that Daniel Day-Lewis was nominated for My Left Foot. So you have these two gorgeous, sexy hunks, both of them trying as hard as they can to portray the greater infirmity, like Tom Cruise. I have no legs, Daniel Day-Lewis. Well, I can only use my toe. And who wins the Oscar? Well, the one with the British accent, of course.
Well, and then, of course, years later, in 2005, Tom Cruise has his famous meltdown on Oprah. We've got just a short edit of it, but we have to remind people of how it came off.
Something happened to you.
I'm in love.
We've never seen you behave this way before.
I know.
Have you ever felt this way before?
That, of course, is the sound of alighting on the couch, arms akimbo, shaking fists up in the air. The audience seemed to relish that downfall. So what is it that crosses too far in a downfall? What goes beyond reinvention?
Well, there's two things going on in that particular clip. First of all, you know, Cruise had recently fired his publicist, his manager.
Right. Replaced it with his sister.
Replaced it with his sister. And his manager had been, Pat Kingsley, had been running his career very, very carefully for decades. And so all of a sudden, he was off message. He was off script. He thought he was behaving the way people in love behave. First of all, that's rarely how people in love behave. But that's also not what we really want from Tom Cruise. The second thing that's going on there, before the internet, that clip might have been laughed about on Letterman for a week and then forgotten. But because of YouTube, that clip was repurposed and played with and toyed with and different soundtracks added and special effects added. And it's almost like we were playing with the corpse of his persona like roadkill.
Although they have pretty charmed lives, I think, on some level, it can't be an easy time to be a movie star. There's almost a demand that your life doesn't encounter any great hiccups or flaws.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, the star's real life is often the subsidiary stream of entertainment. I think of Sandra Bullock, who a couple of years ago had a big comeback. I mean, she was relegated to airplane movies. That was the joke about her. You'd see her movies on airplanes. And then she had, a couple of years ago, she had a big hit, The Proposal, and then she was in The Blind Side and won an Oscar, and she completely restarted her career as a movie star and a movie actress. But it didn't really take until a couple of months later when her husband was cheating on her and she landed on the cover of All the Tabs. And that all of a sudden really fired her up into the stratosphere. It's almost like she had to have a real-life scandal to matter in this new playing field that we have.
I'm wondering if, looking at them now and looking through the cultural history that you wrote in this book, do we create celebrities? Do they create us?
It's a very complex process. It's mysterious. It's some sort of pop cultural algorithm that, you know, I try to get at the bottom of in the book, but I really don't come close. Do we create celebrities? Sure. Do we create stars? Yes. We anoint Clark Gable, you know, or Daniel Day-Lewis by looking at them and saying, wow, I want to see more of that person. They've got something interesting that I want to see more of. Does the star create their persona? Sure. Whether consciously or not, they're projecting something that's a version of themselves. And sometimes it really is conscious. One of my favorite quotes in the book is from John Wayne later in life when he said, yeah, when I started out, I knew I wasn't much of an actor, so I went to work on the Wayne thing, the John Wayne thing. I practiced in front of a mirror. which is the exact opposite of what we think of John Wayne as. We think he was the natural man. We don't even think of him as an actor, but he worked on it. In a way, John Wayne was his greatest performance, was Marion Morrison's greatest performance.
Ty Burr, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Virginia. Appreciate it.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in movies. It doesn't matter who you are.
Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe and author of Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. You'll find more on the book and his previous book, The Best Old Movies for Families, at wordofmouthradio.org.
Their names are written in concrete. Don't step on Greta Garbo as you walk down the boulevard. She looks so weak and fragile. That's why she tried to be so hard. But they turned her into a princess, and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom because she wanted to be alone. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood.
And to a new trend we've spotted, well, I've spotted, I guess, no experts to quote or statistics to consult or even confirmation from the collective brain of my Facebook page. But here it is. Facial hair is getting its close-up, at least by film critics. It all started with Anthony Lane's review of Argo in The New Yorker. If you haven't seen the film, it's set during the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979, with all the clunky glasses and full ashtrays that the production designers could muster. The film is directed by Ben Affleck, who also stars as real-life CIA exfiltrator Tony Mendez. Here's a quote.
Affleck's beard and hairstyle suggest someone who moonlighted from the intelligence services to pose for the joy of sex. And as you study the fashions of the era, you have to ask whether the Ayatollah's fury was provoked by U.S. support for the Shah, or more simply, by the width of Western shirt collars.
It makes a lot of sense now that blowout beards and twirled mustaches, along with skinny jeans, bestow street cred in the hipster boroughs of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, both Portlands, Maine and Oregon, and of course, L.A., where movies come from. You want more? Here's A.O. Scott's take on how the spare American landscape of the era is evoked in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
The smaller, plainer America of the mid-19th century is evoked by the brownest chiaroscuro of Janusz Kaminski's cinematography, by the mud, brick, and wood of Rick Carter's production design, and by enough important facial hair to make the young beard farmers of 21st century Brooklyn weep tears of envy.
Aha! I think I'm onto something. It all came together last weekend when I watched Joe Wright's risky adaptation of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, starring Keira Knightley as the chin-quivering putty in the hands of a woefully miscast Count Vronsky. Those are my words, not A.O. Scott's. So, after the film, I went back to get Scott's take.
Aaron Taylor Johnson, with curly blonde hair, a crisp white uniform, and the kind of mustache that would have melted hearts in an Upper West Side singles bar around 1974, turns Vronsky into a pretty, impulsive enigma.
Two of my favorite reviewers, neither of which have beards, by the way, which may lead one to wonder if they're just jealous of the more hirsute. Despite these observations of their observations, no one is yet petitioning the Academy of Arts and Sciences to include a facial hair category in this year's Oscars. So I'm feeling a little lonesome. If you notice facial hair reviews popping up in unlikely places, like movie reviews, let us know on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for listening. Segments and links from today's stories are available as audio at our website or as podcasts at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie,
with web support from Sarah Plort.
Andrew Perella, that's me,
provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR.
Its board of trustees or its underwriters.
That's right.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.